Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning, 6:04. Welcome to it. Austin Hill in the Morning is the program. I am your host of said program here on the Faith Radio Network. Welcome to it. It's a Friday. And I hope you can maybe kind of breathe a sigh of relief a little bit. We've made it. Although, I hesitate to, you know, go off on those, oh, gee whiz, it's Friday, it's great, because a lot of people work on the weekends, maybe you, and heaven knows that our pastors and church staff members, well, there is no rest for the weary on the weekends. They take a day off on Monday, right? But that said, we've made it through yet another week. I hope your morning is off to a good start, safely and soundly, and hopefully some time with family and friends at some point over the course of the day. We've got lots to talk about, as always. As a matter of fact, coming up here in just a few moments, I've got some, this is just a fun story. You know, in the spirit of the end of the week and Friday and such, I do like to incorporate maybe a little extra dose of fun onto the program. And I've got this couple that I'm going to introduce you to. They are elderly, even by their own definition. They've been married for 72 years. They're from Orlando, Florida. And I'll tell you about the Vanderslices coming up here in just a few moments. This is the kind of thing that will put a smile on your face and offer some hope and encouragement in a world torn asunder and gone awry, where oftentimes it seems like marriages and marital commitment and really any kind of personal commitment is so easily tossed aside. We'll get to that coming up here in just a few moments. A little bit later in the program, I'm going to talk to a legal expert, a gentleman who actually is a law professor out at Liberty University. His name is Ken Klukowski. He's a national best-selling author, constitutional lawyer. He's with the Liberty University School of Law in Virginia. Ken Klukowski, actually, for a number of years, I've known Ken for, my goodness, 12, 13 years now. We go way back. And for a number of years, he served with a nonprofit organization called the Alliance Defending Freedom. And Ken will weigh in here just about half an hour from now here on our program about the outcome, or the fallout, as it may be, from the United States Supreme Court decision involving the Hobby Lobby Corporation. It's kind of loosely described as the Hobby Lobby decision at the Supreme Court. Well, it involved the Hobby Lobby company, but there are already people in the United States Congress and on Capitol Hill. And by the way, this is not a partisan, you know, it's just the Democrats or just the Republicans doing the naughty stuff. That's not it at all. There are members of Congress, all parties, both parties, who just think that in the case of the Supreme Court decision involving Hobby Lobby, this religious liberty thing just went way out of control. Oh, my gosh, if we were all too free, if we had too much religious liberty, that would just be awful. Ken Klukowski is a steady hand in all of it. And he is a Christian himself, but a fine thinker. So he's going to join us in about half an hour to tell us some of the fallout of the Supreme Court decision. Along with that, there is this thing making its way through the Congress called ENDA, E-N-D-A. That stands for Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And I have talks with several people who are leaders at nonprofit Christian ministries, churches, Christian colleges and universities. And they have their eyes on this one. If you are not familiar with ENDA, you need to know what's going on here. And because it really could, depending on how this shakes out in the United States Congress and what the Congress and the President decide to do or not to do, this could have serious ramifications such that the government could step in and tell your church that you have to eliminate certain kinds of criteria in employment practices at the church, or at the Christian university, or your nonprofit ministry, or what have you. So Ken Klukowski, legal expert, comes up later this hour here on Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. When we come back, I can't wait to tell you about the Vanderslices. We need to take a quick break, right? Okay. We did dress rehearsal, but we're kind of working out the bugs here still. The couple married for 72 years. What does that look like? What does it sound like? I'll let you hear it coming up next. Welcome to it. It's Friday. It's Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. 610, good morning and welcome to it. The program is called Austin Hill in the Morning. That's me. I am your host. Honored to be here weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on the Faith Radio Network. Hey, I also want to put it out there. Coming up into the second hour of our program, a gentleman who I had the privilege of conversing with earlier this week, his name is Jonathan Catherman, and the national speaker. Perhaps you've seen him out on the speaking circuit. Maybe he's come and spoken at a church near you or some civic group in your area or what have you. He's got this great new book out. It's called Manual to Manhood. And as the father of a teenage boy, this book really resonated with me. If you are raising a young adolescent or pre-adolescent boy, or maybe you have a grandchild that fits in that category, you want to listen up to what Jonathan Catherman has to say. He'll be joining us in the second hour of our program to talk about stuff that young boys just need. And it's all very biblically grounded and theologically sound, but Jonathan Catherman kind of takes an honest look and says, you know, this is what goes on in the life of men in our culture, and this is what they need to know. So that's coming up into this second hour here on our program, Austin Hill in the Morning. So there's this couple in Orlando, Florida, and I want to thank the folks at ChristianPost.com for reposting this story. It originated actually from WESH-TV in Orlando, Florida. Their names are Francis and Doris Vanderslice. Now, I have some slices, if you will, of audio of these folks, and it's just, you know, cute as a bug in a rug, so to speak. And I want to say, before I go any further, my father-in-law, both of my parents have long since passed away, but my wife's parents are still among us, and they are in failing health. As a matter of fact, my father-in-law is ill with Alzheimer's disease, and that's a whole other topic that we'll cover some other time here on the program. Because that's just rough, and I have empathy for anybody who's dealing with that. One of the great things, I guess I'll say one of the blessings of seeing my father-in-law kind of wind down in his later years. He's in his early 90s now, and it's not pretty, but by the same token, somehow, and maybe it's just, you know, something divine and miraculous, somehow he has managed to retain his sense of humor. And he seems to understand, even with a failing memory not really fully, you know, he's losing his mental faculties. He's not fully mentally functional as he once was. He used to be this great thinker, MDiv graduate from Dallas Theological Seminary, prolific writer, former pastor. Just not all there. But he seems to realize that he's kind of losing it, so to speak, and he laughs at himself. And when somebody has to repeat something over and over and over again, sometimes he'll just burst out laughing, and he'll say, "You just told me that, didn't you?" You know, it's like it just occurs to him, "Wow, this is kind of a trip." Anyway, so I'm experiencing that on some level with my own father-in-law. But then in come the Vanderslices, Francis and Doris. They are celebrating 72 years of marriage this week. And as far as I can tell, they are both of a completely sound mind. And they're a little slow, but you can tell in this video clip, and we'll get this posted on the Austin Hill in the Morning blog page, or at least linked to it anyway, at our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. But they're kind of having some fun, especially Mr. Vanderslice. He's kind of like digging the whole thing about being on TV, and they're kind of laughing at each other, at themselves, and everybody else, and having some good fun. Now, I want you to listen. This is Frances Vanderslice. She's, by the way, she's 97 years old. I'm sorry, this is Doris. Doris is the wife. Francis is the husband. Doris is 97. Francis is 98. And this is Doris describing, and Aaron, we have the first soundbite. Okay, this is Doris describing what it was like the first time she ever laid eyes on the man who would be her husband. They first met each other, I think they were in seventh grade at junior high school. So in walks the husband into the room, the future husband. This was Doris's recollection of it. Listen to this.
When I saw him, I said, and I'm still saying it.
Okay. See, there you go. So that's Doris, her recollection of that day some, you know, over 72 years ago. All right. So that was that's the first part of the TV interview. Now, apparently, And this is kind of interesting here. Apparently, and I didn't do this when my wife and I got married. We didn't do this, and I guess some people still do this at weddings. But I'm sure you're accustomed to the practice of sometimes people will attach different kinds of articles, different kinds of items to the back of a vehicle. As the couple drives off after the wedding, they leave the church and they drive to the honeymoon spot, and maybe they're dragging, crazy things like tin cans or metal cans dragging from behind the vehicle just to make noise and to draw attention, and you've got, grease paint on the windows just married and all that kind of stuff. Well, apparently, Mr. and Mrs. Vanderslice, they had several cans tied to the back of their vehicle, and apparently old Francis, he retained one of these cans. And apparently he hid one, and he kept it all these years. And so, here's Francis talking about the cans and the individual can that got retained, and he's just recently brought it out some 72 years later. Here it is.
I bounced along the back of my car for, 60 miles when we went on our honeymoon, and it was the only can left on there.
Okay, so it's the only can that survived the 60-mile trip. So then Doris weighs in, and she says, my goodness, I am so pleasantly surprised. What a fine husband I have here. He retained the can, and she thinks that's kind of romantic.
But I never knew he was that romantic.
Okay, there you go. Thank you, Doris. Now, here's Francis, and this was one of the moments where he's mugging up for the camera in a very fun way, and you can just barely hear at the end of the soundbite, barely hear him chuckling, but the news reporter there in Orlando says, well, what's the secret here of your relationship and holding it together and all of that kind of stuff? And here's how he responded.
We enjoy being together. Sometimes.
Sometimes. Okay, very good. And then at the end of the reporter asks Doris, she says, what advice do you have for couples in the long run? And 72 years of marriage. This is profound. What can we glean from this? Here's the wisdom Doris imparts at the end of the interview.
Do things together. Make decisions together.
And would that it were that it was that simple. But maybe it is. That's some real wisdom. Anyway, Mr. and Mrs. Francis Vanderslice celebrating 72 years of marriage this week in Orlando, Florida. You didn't think it could still happen in this crazy world that we live in, right? But it does, and we can glean wisdom from that. Just wanted to pass it along. It's Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network at 6:18. Our program continues in moments. Thank you for being here. Hope your day is off to a great start. I am Austin Hill, and the program is called Austin Hill in the Morning here on the Faith Radio Network. I believe most of the affiliate radio stations, I think probably the radio station you're listening to right now, if indeed you're listening to us live real time on our broadcast radio affiliates, you can hear us anytime, of course, at our mobile-friendly websites, myfaithradio.com. But if you're listening to us over broadcast radio or online radio, most of the affiliates carry a program that I posted for quite some time now, actually, on the weekends. It's called Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business. And, that may seem strange to have a business program on your local Christian talk radio station. But fortunately, it seems to have been quite well received. And I hope you'll join me coming up tomorrow, Saturday, for the program. This is the kind of topic, I say this because this is the kind of topic that we address frequently on Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business. And we spoke earlier this week about young people and plans over the summer and church youth group activities that transpire over the summer and such. And I have been a big advocate on the weekend program, Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business, a big advocate for getting kids, even maybe preteen kids, depending on the level of maturity and the capabilities of the individual child. And parents know best in these kinds of situations. Okay, I've been a big advocate of getting children involved in business activities. Now, that might mean an internship, and that's kind of catches people off guard when you talk about a 13, 14, 15-year-old, maybe even a 16, 17-year-old pursuing an internship. We customarily think of internships as something that doesn't happen until you get into college. That doesn't have to be the case. And I've often cited my own son, who's now about ready to enter his junior year of high school. He's 15, but when he was 12, he approached a local store, a local business in our hometown, and said, I'd like an internship. Although he didn't call it an internship, he actually said, I'd like to come in here and volunteer and learn from you. And it's been just a tremendous experience. It kind of turned the school officials and his junior high school upside down. They said, whoa, wait a minute, we don't do that. But they kind of came around and saw the value of it. And it was transformative in many different ways for a lot of different people, namely my son and our family. Well, in comes this news. I guess we needed the Canucks to weigh in on this one and clarify this for us. But a study out of the University of British Columbia finds that students who work over the summer months or in the evenings during the school year and work more or less full-time during the summer months have good employment and higher salaries later than life. That is to say that the job at the local drive-thru window or working at the car wash, oh, my goodness, just thinking about being out of doors working on cars over the summer months, that's rough work. But the job at the restaurant or the car wash or what have you might not be particularly glamorous, might not be nearly as fun as, oh, say, summer camp, trips to the lake, trips to the beach, but it could pay off later in life and give young people great competitive advantages. And this is, based on research out of the University of British Columbia. Now, some of the benefits that teenagers experience from working early in life, the study finds, is that it seems to help them focus on their work preferences. It seems to inculcate in them discipline to do things that they maybe don't necessarily like doing or want to do, but they understand that those things need to be done. And it also creates, how do you like this, a network for the young people. Yes, even preteen children can learn and begin to learn the value of networking, being a resource to other people, but also developing people who can be resources for them and references. I mean, when you're 12, 13, 14, 16, 17, 18, references from adults that say, this young person is capable and I highly recommend them, that goes a long, long way. A long way. And again, we're accustomed to thinking in terms of academic references as high schoolers prepare to go to college. But let's not forget the labor market. Let's not forget the workforce. We need to inculcate in our children. I say this as a parent myself. My wife and I are facing the dilemmas and the struggles day to day, raising a teenage son. But I'm in this with you. We need to be raising up a generation of young people who understand their faith, who are well-grounded in the scriptures, and who also understand that a part of God's call on their life is to be productive, to produce things, to provide services, to serve others. Big part of it. Very interesting data out of the University of British Columbia. By the way, get over to myfaithradio.com. Had a great interview earlier this week with an author named Jimmy Collins, who has a book out about teaching children and young people how to follow and follow directions in the marketplace. MyFaithRadio.com. You can check that out. 6:25. It's Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. Our program continues momentarily. Good morning, 6:36. Glad you're with us. It's the Austin Hill in the Morning program on the Faith Radio Network. Coming up later this morning, we're going to talk about manhood. And that's not, by the way, that's not a discussion merely for men and fathers and sons. If you're a single mom trying to raise a young boy, or several of them for that matter, you want to listen up. We've got the author of a great new book called The Manual to Manhood, a gentleman who speaks in churches and civic groups all over the country. Jonathan Catherman joins us into the next hour, and we'll give away copies of his book. This is really good stuff. That's still to come here on the Austin Hill in the Morning program. Now, earlier this week, we talked quite a bit on Monday here about the Supreme Court decision, the decision of the United States Supreme Court that upheld the religious liberties of the owners of the Hobby Lobby Corporation. It's kind of loosely described as, yeah, it's the Hobby Lobby decision. Well, That's our sort of our slang term for describing it. There is already a rush to judgment, shall we say. People say, whoa, wait a minute, this religious liberty stuff, this is crazy. We can't let this get out of control like this. Too much religious liberty, my goodness, the republic will crumble. Well, I don't see it that way. I think religious liberty is profoundly important. That said, there is fallout, and you know, for every action, there's a reaction. Certainly reaction to the Supreme Court decision. There was a very good decision. Joining us to talk about it, senior legal analyst for Breitbart News. He's also a law professor. His name is Ken Klukowski. He joins us on the Newsline here on the Faith Radio Network. Ken, welcome to the program. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning, Austin. Thanks for having me.
Good to speak to you. Tell us about the reaction to the Supreme Court decision that we're speaking of.
Well, it's been deeply disturbing, and I think everything you just said in the intro is completely accurate. Religious liberty is the founding freedom of America. It's the reason this country was first permanently settled by the Pilgrims and then by people of various faiths.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no fewer than four provisions in the supreme law of the land, the U.S. Constitution, pertaining to religious liberty. Three of them in the First Amendment that everyone is guaranteed as a fundamental right, the free exercise of their religion,
mm-hmm.
which includes living out your religion in your daily life, which would include your daily business life. If you're a member of the Green family, for example, that owns the Hobby Lobby company.
Yes.
And then you also have the Establishment Clause, which gives you a fundamental right not to have a government-established religion that you are coerced to be a part of it. Nothing, you know, there's nothing unconstitutional about a Ten Commandments display or a cross or whatnot. The Constitution is violated if anyone is coercing you or anyone to pray to something, to bow before something, to give money to something. It's a matter of protecting your conscience.
Okay.
Also, the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment separately guarantees as a fundamental right your right to believe whatever you want, whether it's politics or religion, and to be able to freely express that to someone else without government sanction because of it. And then finally, the Religious Test Clause of the Constitution guarantees that no person will be denied public office
mm-hmm.
by the government because of their sincerely held religious faith. We have all of those rights, and yet the reaction you've seen over the past week from some on the left, including, very scary, some of the top Democrat leaders at the national level in this country, has been to completely reject that concept and to say, well, if a Christian business owner doesn't want to pay for abortion, then clearly something is wrong in America, and we need to make that happen.
All right, Ken Klukowski, he is a senior legal analyst at Breitbart News. He's also a law professor at the Law School Liberty University. He's on the Newsline here on the Faith Radio Network. Ken, to that point, you were referencing earlier, citing passages of the U.S. Constitution, and I took notes as you were speaking, and you said, you know, but it is unconstitutional to have anybody forcing you to bow and worship a particular god or worship in a particular fashion. Nobody can force these things on you, and yet we have people, and I dare say it's not just Democrats, it's Democrats and Republicans, people in public office who say, oh, my gosh. Oh, my goodness. The Hobby Lobby decision is such that the owners of Hobby Lobby are now empowered to force their religious views on their employees. Now, I look at that and say, that's false. That's utterly false. Nobody is forced to take a job at Hobby Lobby. Nobody is forced to accept the health care benefits that are provided or not provided at the Hobby Lobby HR department. But that's how it's being construed. This is being described, as you well know, and you address this at Breitbart.com. The Hobby Lobby Corporation is being characterized as this unruly, out of control company that's forcing its conservative Christian theology on other people. Speak to that, if you would, Ken.
That's right. 2 points to that. First of all, the Establishment Clause does not give anyone a right to live in a secular society. The Establishment Clause gives you rights only against the government coercing you to participate in a government religion. It gives no rights whatsoever. If you choose to freely work at a private company, it gives you no rights whatsoever to say that the owner or manager of that company has to check their religious faith at the door. Everyone in this society is free to decide where they want to work, and certainly Hobby Lobby and countless other companies as well. People know if you are working for a Christian business, and the same could be said for an Orthodox Jewish business or whatnot.
Sure.
You know if you are working at a faith-based business, and if that business owner makes it crystal clear that they plan on running their business consistently with their faith, they might say, hey, there'll be no profanity here. We won't use the Lord's name in vain. We're not going to work on Sunday. You know, if someone shows up drinking, that's going to be a problem here. If a business owner, it's like their house. In America, in the free enterprise system, people are free to set up their own business the way they would their household and to live out their own values and their own faith there. What's so frustrating, the second part, the second point to that, is no one is saying you can't have birth control. In fact, as I said in my most recent piece, this case wasn't about birth control. It was about abortion. The plaintiffs in Hobby Lobby were not challenging birth control, only four types that actually induce abortions, chemical abortions. And it's not saying even that those employees cannot obtain abortions. It's just saying that the Christian business owner mm-hmm. who believes abortion ends a human life should not have to pay for it. That was the infringement on the owner's religious liberty. It's just saying if you're going to get an abortion, the government is not going to coerce faithful Christians or other pro-life Americans to have to pay for it out of their own pockets.
I also want to ask you, and I'm coming up on a break here in just a couple of minutes. I hope you can stay over for another brief segment. I want to ask you about this ENDA thing, the Employee Non-Discrimination Act. I hear pastors and leaders of nonprofit Christian ministries, Christian colleges and universities, churches. A lot of people are watching this very, very carefully. It's not law yet, but it's something that's in the works in the United States Congress. Just to complete the thought on this Supreme Court decision, is the reaffirmation of religious liberty that we saw and experienced from the Supreme Court, what, about a week and a half ago, is that in jeopardy right now?
Yes.
Why?
Because precisely the same principles are in play. Abortion is nowhere mentioned in the U.S. Constitution.
Okay.
And yet you are having national leaders of one of the two national parties in this country, including the sitting president of the United States and the Democratic frontrunner to be the next president of the United States, Hillary Clinton, saying that your religious liberty rights are secondary to other people's abortion rights, even though religious liberty is guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution and the word abortion never comes up. The same thing is going on with the homosexual social agenda, that you are having those seeking to pass ENDA and whatnot, you are having those who are seeking to say that whatever your religious faith is, you can't live it out in any aspect of your life. There was recently the example of a young 27, 28-year-old Christian photographer in New Mexico who had a fine imposed against her, Elaine Huguenin, because she declined to take the job. She just declined to take the money to photograph a lesbian commitment ceremony. There wasn't even gay marriage in New Mexico. There wasn't civil unions. This was a ceremony that had no legal significance whatsoever.
Okay.
And yet she was assessed a fine when she said, I'm just not comfortable doing that. Jack Phillips is a baker in Colorado. Same thing. There was a gay couple that wanted him to make a rainbow-colored wedding cake in a state that had no gay marriage. He said he was not comfortable with that, and he is under a court order. If he refuses again, he could actually go to jail for it.
Right.
These are extraordinary and unprecedented threats to faithful Christians and to people of all religious faiths in terms of their ability to just live out their faith in their daily life, and ENDA would actually codify much of that into federal law.
All right. Hold on. We'll continue in just a moment. Again, as I said, I have heard from pastors and leaders of Christian nonprofit organizations, even Christian colleges and universities. They're watching this ENDA phenomena very carefully. Ken Klukowski, senior legal analyst, Breitbart News, law professor, Liberty University. He'll be with us again in just moments. It's Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. Thanks for being here. Austin Hill in the Morning is the program. It's the Faith Radio Network, 6:49 Central Time. And still to come, manhood, a topic of discussion. Raising up young boys, adolescent and pre-adolescent boys to be responsible men. We'll address that at the top of the next hour here on Austin Hill in the Morning. Ken Klukowski is an attorney, a law professor at Liberty University. He's also the senior legal analyst at BreitbartNews.com. Ken, again, as I've reiterated, I was just in a lunch appointment earlier this week speaking to a leader of a great Christian university, one of the leadership team at a Christian university, and they said, we're watching this Employee Non-Discrimination Act, this proposed legislation, watching that very carefully as it makes its way to the Congress. As I understand it, there were religious exemptions built into the law. So some of these coercive things that you were describing a few moments ago would not be codified into law. And once the members of Congress said, okay, we'll allow exemptions for religious groups, a lot of very secular groups said, well, forget it. We don't support this thing then. And it appears as though the whole end of thing has collapsed, but maybe not. What's your assessment of that?
My concern is that ENDA is still advancing, and it's because there's been an atmosphere since the Supreme Court ruling. I'll tell you, as someone who's participated in more than a dozen U.S. Supreme Court cases, that whenever the Supreme Court speaks clearly on an issue, it has enormous ripple effect at the federal, state, and local level, just across the board on issues. And when it became clear that Justice Anthony Kennedy agreed with the liberal justice, I think it's a deeply concerning ruling, that he said that the Defense of Marriage Act, which had been overwhelmingly passed, over 85% of Congress, of both parties in the House and Senate, had voted for DOMA. It was signed into law into 1996 by Bill Clinton.
President Clinton,
When Justice Anthony Kennedy became the fifth vote, then with the four liberal justices, to hold that DOMA was motivated purely by an irrational hostility towards gay people, that it served no legitimate purposes whatsoever, that it was designed to demean, disparage, and injure some of our fellow citizens. The lower courts and the whole political establishment among elected leaders got the wave of that. Legislation that seeks to secure any rights that would deny the gay community something that it is demanded, that those are inherently illegitimate, that there are no legitimate concerns being advanced by it. That's where you've gotten. You already had these rulings coming in that I just referenced regarding New Mexico, regarding Colorado. Those were already coming down. Those decisions had already been issued. The Windsor decision regarding DOMA from the Supreme Court has just accelerated all that, when the reality is no matter what the words of the law are on a book, if you have someone who says, well, I think I'm being treated illegally here and I'm going to choose to sue, there's ultimately going to be a judicial officer that hears that claim. And I'm just, the way ENDA is currently written, and for those who are currently pushing for it, including even some Republicans who would normally be reliable on such an issue, I am gravely concerned as to what the implications would be for people like the owners of Hobby Lobby or Conestoga Wood Specialties, its companion case, if the subject matter were to be someone who says, I want the company to give gay marital rights to my homosexual partner, if the subject matter were gay marriage instead of abortion.
Sounds to me like what you're saying, Ken Klukowski, is that it's not just the Supreme Court ruling, but it's the reaction to the ruling that is shaping and forming our nation's public policy, and ENDA is certainly something that we'll keep an eye on. Ken Klukowski, senior legal analyst with Breitbart News. He is a law professor at Liberty University. And Ken, as always, thanks so much for joining us. We'll look forward to talking to you again. I hope you have a great day.
Same here, Austin. Thanks
good,
so much.
Good to be with you. We'll get that info posted on our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com, on our blog page for Austin Hill in the Morning. It's 6:53. This is the Faith Radio Network. Good morning and welcome to it. It's the Austin Hill in the Morning program on Faith Radio Network. Live the Promise with Susie Larson. It happens weekday afternoons, 3 p.m. Central Time here on the Faith Radio Network. Here's a little bit of what you can catch on the program. Here's Susie talking with author Wendy Blight.
It's not just a mental ascent. It's total new transformation. The old has passed away. We're made a new creation. And I think we forget about that miraculous transaction that happens when we become saved, because so often we still default to old ways of thinking, even old ways of assessing our own lives, our frailties, and our circumstances. And so to keep our mind renewed, to remember we're new creations, and it matters if we think that way, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And it helps so much because, Susie, as we've talked about with my other book, so many times what's happened in the past, whether it's been done to us or some choices we've made, we allow those things to define us, and they can sometimes hold us in prisons and in dark places. And when we realize that when we accept Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior, he takes all of that away, and we become a new creation. We are a new creation. As you said, the old is gone and the new has come. And any remnant of that old that remains is just enough of what we need to be able to take that test and make it our testimony, to be able to go forward and use that to encourage others, comfort others, equip others.
Well, you referenced the Voice translation. I've never heard of it. I cannot even believe that I've never heard of it. And I just had so much fun prepping for today's show, looking at different different verses in the Voice translation. And so this one that you referenced, Romans 5, verses 20 to 21, it absolutely, Wendy, it took my breath away, and I'm just going to read it. This is Romans 5:20 to 21 from the Voice translation. I think it's kind of like the Message translation along that line, isn't it? A little bit, kind of a paraphrase. Is that what that is? Or
well, yeah, it's important for me to say this. It's that Thomas Nelson put this Bible out, and it is not a paraphrase.
Oh, good to
it's
know.
An actual, yeah, it's an actual translation. You can look in the front. It has many, many scholars and theologians that help put it together. So it is an actual translation, but you are right. It is the most beautifully written Bible that you will ever open, and it really does make scriptures that you've known for a long time come alive in a fresh way to read them from the Voice.
Well, I appreciate that. In fact, I'm going to go on Amazon or go to my local bookstore and get a copy, because I just couldn't believe it. So here's Romans 5, verses 20 to 21. When the law came into the picture, sin grew and grew. But wherever sin grew and spread, God's grace was there in fuller, greater measure. No matter how much sin crept in, there was always more grace. In the same way that sin reigned in the sphere of death, now grace reigns through God's restorative justice, eclipsing death and leading to eternal life through the Anointed One, Jesus our Lord, the liberating King. I mean, that makes me want to stand up and put my arms in the air.
I know.
Wendy Blight, author Wendy Blight, being interviewed on Live the Promise, the program hosted by Susie Larson, weekday afternoons at 3. Check out myfaithradio.com. You can hear that in its entirety, and then you have a listen to Susie Larson and Live the Promise. My goodness. Central Time, 3 p.m. weekday afternoons. This is Austin Hill in the Morning, into the second hour, manhood, raising up boys. We'll have some tips on how to do that and so much more. Stay with us.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Hey, good morning. 7:04. The Austin Hill in the Morning program is on the Faith Radio Network. Thank you for being here. I am honored that you've chosen to spend some time with us. I'm here weekday morning, 6 till 8. And listen, we've got lots to talk about in our upcoming hour. I hope you'll stay with us. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about manhood. And you'll meet an author, a gentleman who I had the privilege of speaking with earlier this week. He's got a great book out called The Manual to Manhood. Now, if you're raising sons, you're raising boys. Even if you're going it alone, you're a single dad, you're a single mom. Especially, I want to talk to the single moms here. But hey, my wife and I, we are raising a teenage son together. And even with two of us in the household, it's sufficiently challenging to know at all times how best do we inculcate the proper skills, the proper measure of values. How do we address dilemmas and challenges as they come up? Parenting is just difficult. that's the quick paraphrase. Parenting is just tough. And you'll meet Jonathan Katherman, an author of The Manual to Manhood. Some great suggestions on just, you know, basic stuff, life skills that boys need to learn at a young age so they can actually flourish and be productive, as well as be humble servants when they reach adulthood. So that's coming up later this hour. And matter of fact, Aaron, we have some copies of the book to give away, right? We'll be doing that. Stand by. We'll give you a chance to pick up a copy of Mr. Katherman's book coming up a little bit later this hour as well. I want to, just real quick here before we head to a break, we've got this news we'll put on our blog page at myfaithradio.com. But there is a couple, believe it or not, celebrating 72 years of marriage in Orlando, Florida. The husband's name is Francis. The wife's name is Doris. It's Francis and Doris Vanderslice of Orlando, Florida. They are age 98 and age 97, respectively. The husband, Francis, is 98 and Doris is 97. And this is the sweetest thing. I'll let you a little bit later this hour. I'll sort of tell their story in full detail. This is just the cutest thing. I love this. This is 97-year-old Doris Vanderslice talking about that first moment when she first laid eyes on her future husband. This was when they were in seventh grade, by the way. Here's how the magic happened.
When I saw him, I said, and I'm still saying it.
And isn't that just the sweetest thing? 72 years. Yes, it actually can happen. And isn't it great? Can't we? Let's just thank the Lord for examples like the Vanderslices that are still among us. We'll tell you their story coming up later this morning here on Austin Hill in the Morning. When we return, let's talk about the a very, very difficult challenge that a lot of communities around the country are facing. Parents are facing this in their local public schools. Other people are facing it in their workplaces. And that is the phenomena of transgendered public policy. You know, rules that say, hey, everybody uses the same restroom. If we had men use the men restroom and we have women use the women's restroom, well, that would be discriminatory. And what you get are adult men in the same restrooms with underage girls. That's one of the phenomena that come out of this. How do we address this thoughtfully and respectfully? We'll talk to an expert from a group called the Culture of Life Foundation about what to do about this issue of gender identity. That's coming up next on Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. Thank you for listening. It's the Austin Hill in the Morning program here on the Faith Radio Network. I'm here weekday morning, 6 till 8. I appreciate you being with us this morning. How do you address the issue if somebody comes into your workplace or maybe even at your child's school, for example, and says, when it's objectively obvious, you were born male or you were born female, they step in and say, but I identify with the opposite gender. Yes, I was born female, perhaps, but I identify as a man. And the rules of the office or the school or the workplace or what have you, everything needs to change to accommodate my gender identity. This is very, very complex. It poses very serious challenges to, things that have been implicitly obvious or presumed to be implicitly obvious down through the course of Western civilization. Certainly poses challenges to our understandings of scriptural teaching and, very basic theology about the origins of the human person. Joining us to talk about it, a lady who's in the know of these things. She's with the Culture of Life Foundation, a nonprofit foundation. Her name is Jennifer Kimball Watson. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us here on the Faith Radio Network.
Thanks for having me, Austin.
What sort of challenges are we seeing emerge with these new ideas about so-called gender identity? I mentioned some of the challenges we're seeing in public schools and in workplaces, government buildings, and so forth. What does this look like from your vantage point?
Well, there are quite a few of these issues are popping up, as you have noted. The most recent in Houston, where a city ordinance has now passed the Equal Rights Ordinance prohibiting discrimination in public facilities and private employment on the basis of what they call protective characteristics. Of course, those characteristics are sexual orientation, gender identity, which includes disability, pregnancy, even genetic information. But more for this issue, we're talking about sexual orientation and gender identity in folks who, you know, are going to be sharing the same facilities on public facilities. And I would like to note that this ordinance in Houston is not only public facilities, but also private employment. So, you know, we can say, I don't want to allow this person, to work in my place of business.
Mm-hmm.
But really takes us back to several other issues. One going back to, I believe, in the state of Washington in March, where a private high school, a gentleman, one of the teachers who was struggling with this, you know, very unfortunate and, problem of gender identity, and he felt he was, you know, truly a woman trapped in a man's body. He left the school, went ahead, had a sex change, and came back to teach at that same school now as a woman. And so this is where the waters really get a little murky as far as the advocacy that is out there, what the media is saying. And, you know, we have to remember, yes, absolute compassion belongs to these folks. There is no doubt that they are suffering. But by redefining their pathology, which, by the way, the APA has actually recently removed the diagnosis for gender disorder removal of transgenderism as a something wrong, mm-hmm. psychologically, which is truly unfortunate because that means. Well, where else do we have, you know, what other recourse do we have to treat these poor people? Because they truly are suffering. Now, so the advocacy and then the policy right now would have us say, well, we were not going to treat them. We're just going to redefine their reality, and then we're going to assume them into our own public lives the way they want to be, which you and I know means that a man who wants to be a woman who has not had a sex change is welcome into either a bathroom or a swimming locker changing room with our daughters and our wives and
sure.
our friends and so forth. Now, is the, you know, the real question, is this right? I mean, first of all, I'm going to say we know this is not a therapy.
All right. And Jennifer Kimball Watson, she's with the Culture of Life Foundation. You can find them at cultureoflife.org. She's on the news line here on the Faith Radio Network. I'm zeroing in on the public policy and, I guess, the public safety concerns, as you're getting at here, Jennifer. Indeed, this is one of the implications. A man who exhibits no external feminine qualities, he's not attempting to dress like a woman, there's no surgical or hormonal treatment. He simply says one day, and this is law in my native home state of California now, children that are in kindergarten for all intents and purposes, a young kindergarten boy can show up at school one day and say, I identify as a girl, and he can then use the girl's restroom. Or if not that we necessarily have athletic lockers for kindergartners, but this is how arbitrary and subjective this is. And one of the implications sure. here, as you're describing, is indeed an adult male who looks male can say, I identify as a woman, so he's in the stall next to my 12-year-old daughter, or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
How do we protect ourselves in that regard?
Well, that's the question of the day. How do we? I mean, we obviously need to fight these pieces of legislation, these ordinances, to say, wait a second, you know, how can you say that this person is suffering, you know, trumps the rights I have to protect my daughter or, you know, that my wife has or that I have and, you know, protecting my, you know, my own reality? I mean, one of the questions they're not talking about here is, you know, we're focused on and, you know, policy is focused on, advocacy, the media is focused on these poor people. Absolutely, yes. But what about those individuals who, you know, have another pathology that I don't want to mention for the show that, you know, would prefer to use this right, this newfound, you know, arbitrary right, to go to, into a woman's locker room for other reasons other than their own sexual identity. And, you know, we can't help but speculate whether, you know, this is going to, you know, just give an open door to perpetrators of you know, rape and violence and you know, and looky-loos and so forth. And so, you know, that is a concern. And, of course, the opposition or the proponents of this are saying, oh, there's, you know, there's, this is not what we're talking about. You know, you can't discriminate. But really, there is no research that we can find, that our organization has been able to find, that actually, you know, shows that this is not, that these people are not, you know, are not violent, have no tendencies towards, you know, this kind of violent behavior. Because clearly when you're suffering with one, you know, issue psychologically,
mm-hmm.
there are effects. There are causes, but there are also other effects that go along with it.
All right. Jennifer Kimball Watson, she's with the Culture of Life Foundation. You can find her and her associates and their work at cultureoflife.org. And there's lots of good content to read there at their website at cultureoflife.org. Jennifer, just real quick, is there growing concern? Do you see a critical mass of concern over the public safety issues involved here?
I do. However, it's not quite as organized as we would like to have it. And part of that reason is because you're jumping from, you know, let's say up in Massachusetts where you have a piece of legislation to Houston where we have a city ordinance. And the language differs a little bit. And so it's not as, you know, I mean, it's like a whack-a-mole program at your local fair, sadly. And we really do need to call into action, you know, more psychologists, more people in the science industry to say, wait a second, you know, this is harmful. This is harmful to our public. It's harmful to our youth. We're putting our families and our friends, our loved ones, and others at risk for people who, you know, really are suffering a disorder that they would rather have imposed upon others. I mean, let's face it. You go into a men's bathroom. I mean, the men's bathrooms are set up for the anatomy of a man.
Sure.
The women's bathrooms are set up for the anatomy of a woman.
And so, and it's we've accepted that as normative in our culture for really all of my lifetime and probably yours as well. Jennifer Kimball Watson, cultureoflife.org is where you can find her. Again, some excellent reading materials for those of us who want to get tooled up and studied up on the issue. Jennifer, as always, thanks much for joining us. We'll look forward to talking again soon as a very complex issue unfolds across our country and throughout our culture. And it's not to be taken lightly. When we come back, can a marriage really last 72 years? Yes, sir. We've got the news from the city of Orlando, Florida. We'll tell you all about that. Also, Raising Up Boys, the manual to manhood is what we'll introduce you to. It's the Austin Hill in the Morning program on the Faith Radio Network. Austin Hill in the Morning at 7:21 on the Faith Radio Network. Coming up into the next half hour, the Manual for Manhood. You'll meet the author of said book. He speaks in churches and to civic groups, and sometimes I think he even speaks to corporations and social service agencies around the country. But Jonathan Katzerman, author of The Manual to Manhood, will join us and tell us about some basic life skills as he goes through his list of basic life skills that every boy needs to eventually develop so as to be fully a man. You'll find yourself nodding, going, I like that. And especially if you are a woman, perhaps a young woman, maybe not so young, if you're a single woman, as you listen to Jonathan Katzerman describe these basic life skills, you'll probably say, man, I'd like to meet a guy like that. And so let's get to work on it. The Manual to Manhood coming up in just a few moments. Can marriage really last a lifetime? Sometimes it's difficult to believe that in a world torn asunder where commitments of all sorts, marital commitments included, seem to be so easily abandoned. Let me introduce you to Doris and Francis Vanderslice. They are celebrating 72 years of marriage. Thanks very much to the folks at the Christian Post, ChristianPost.com, and WESH-TV in Orlando, Florida, for bringing us this story. The reporter at the TV station there in Orlando, she sat down with Mr. and Mrs. Vanderslice and started off by asking Doris, tell us about that moment, Doris. When you first met your husband-to-be, they were in junior high school, by the way. I think she was in seventh grade, and old Francis was an eighth grader at the time. Here's Doris reminiscing some 72 years ago, well, actually more than 72 years ago, when he first walked into the room. How's that? Listen to this.
When I saw him, I said, and I'm still saying it.
Okay, well, so we're off to a fun start. Now, at their wedding 72 years ago, they had people tie cans behind the vehicle, and the cans dragged as they, you know, left the church, drove off into the sunset, and headed out for their honeymoon. And Francis has actually saved one of the cans tied to the vehicle that swept them away for their honeymoon. This is Francis talking about the one that dragged for how many miles was it, 60 or something like that? Listen to this.
I bounced along the back of my car for, I guess, 60 miles when we went on our honeymoon, and there was the only can left on there.
All right. Now, just for fun, just as an anecdote from their wedding and their honeymoon, Francis, husband Francis, has saved the can. He just recently brought it out. It was packed in the attic, as I understood it. And Doris thought that that was very sweet of her 72-year husband. Here's what Doris had to say.
I thought I never knew he was that romantic.
Okay. Now, what, isn't this fun? What has kept this couple together for all these many years? This is kind of a point in the television interview there at WESH-TV in Orlando, where you can just tell Francis is, he's loving his moment on TV. He's having some fun. He's got this big grin on his face, and he kind of chuckles under his breath as he says this. But what has held them together? Here's Francis' answer.
We enjoy being together. Sometimes.
Sometimes, okay. And at the end of the discussion, Doris has asked, what advice would you have? After 72 years of marriage, Doris, what advice would you offer younger couples for holding it together and really creating a loving relationship that lasts a lifetime? And the advice is pretty straightforward.
Do things together. Make decisions together.
Makes sense to me. Francis and Doris Vanderslice of Orlando, Florida, celebrating 72 years of marriage. Happy anniversary to the Vanderslices of Orlando, and thanks for the fine example you provide us. When we come back, time for a plugged-in movie review. You headed out to see a motion picture over the weekend? Well, we'll let you hear Bob Wallacewski's plugged-in review coming up in just moments. Also later this hour, the manual to manhood, basic stuff that young men need to learn so they can grow into full manhood. Talk about it all here on Austin Hill in the Morning. This is the Faith Radio Network. Good morning. Austin Hill in the Morning is what you're listening to here on the Faith Radio Network. Glad you're with us. So, pretty straightforward question. How do we raise up the next generation of men? Author of the brand new book, The Manual to Manhood, How to Cook the Perfect Steak, Change a Tire, Impress a Girl, and 97 Other Skills You Need to Survive. Author and consultant Jonathan Katherman joins us on the guest line. Jonathan, welcome to Austin Hill in the Morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is quite a compilation you put together here, life skills for young men and for boys. Are men lacking in basic life skills? Is that one of the reasons why you put this book together?
No, it wasn't necessarily that they're lacking in basic life skills as much as young men in the making are lacking in basic life skills. I think that there's a lot of dads and older men who have acquired these things that maybe just aren't passing them on to the younger generation on purpose. There's a lot of reasons for that, but this is just one of those bridge pieces, something that kind of breaks the ice with the young man and or still something that's not being offered to them in their life.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that in some cases those skills are not being handed down intentionally, or is it the case that in some cases dads never got it to begin with? I mean, how do you view that?
Well, I think you're fair there on both of those. let's start with the intentional context. Think about how much time crunch we have today and everybody having the available time to see each other face-to-face, eye-to-eye, and interact in a way that's not digital, it's actual. And for a lot of fathers and sons, when it comes to that coming-of-age rites of passage, whether it's shaving or learning how to change a tire or grill that steak, there's just too many times where they're not in the same place at the same time in that moment of need. So, unfortunately, there's a need for a piece like this book, Manual to Manhood, for the dads who aren't connecting. And at the other end of the spectrum, of course, I know many men my own age who have sons who are coming of age who don't know how to do the things in this book. And they're getting the book, and they're half laughing and half serious. Oh, man, I really need to know how to do these things myself. My son and I can learn them together.
Yeah.
Which I find a little bit ironic, yet at the same time, I'm quite thankful they have the resource.
Yeah, no, good for you. And as a father of a teenage son myself, I wasn't laughing when I picked up your book, Jonathan. I said, yeah, this is good. Finally, somebody else is addressing some of the same concerns and interests and, in some cases, inadequacies that I have. It strikes me as a real companion resource for fathers and sons and even moms and sons in some cases if dad's not around. Jonathan Catherman, he's on our guest line here on Austin Hill in the Morning. His new book, The Manual to Manhood, he addresses 100 skills that a young man needs to survive. You've got all these different categories going on here, and you address grooming and personal hygiene. A lot of guys are probably rolling their eyes saying, whatever, and a lot of women are about ready to high-five each other. They're thrilled that you're finally talking about this. What need did you see with grooming and personal hygiene that compelled you to write that chapter?
Oh, and when I meet young men around the country at leadership conferences or speaking events, and I'm taken back by, I can smell them before I can see them, and it's really an over application of cologne.
Yes.
Or when you're making a first impression with someone and they smile and you're realizing, I'm not sure when this guy brushed his teeth last.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to be dramatic about it, but I do know that every young man craves two basic needs. I think every man does. And they're to gain respect and avoid embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
And when we don't know how to present ourselves, whether it's they haven't learned how to shave yet or apply deodorant or too many layers of some scented cologne and hairspray or extra hair wash and body wash, and then you got 18 layers of Axe or something like that. It's just there's a presentation point where you say they aren't in control of their personal life, and here they're out in public presenting themselves. And there's got to be a place where we can say, hey, you know what, the little things add up, and that personal hygiene, whether it's caring for your own feet or freshening your breath, or even knowing how to apply hair products, these little things add up. And there's a whole, like bricks in a building, which one matters most? Well, the one that's not there, that's the one that matters most.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these little bricks that they're lacking. So give them a tool, give them an opportunity to gain the little bits of respect that build up to the big levels of confidence in their life.
Jonathan Catherman, author of the book, The Manual to Manhood, with us here on Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. I note that the very first chapter of your book, Jonathan, is entitled Women and Dating, addressing issues of women and dating and healthy relationships with women. That came first in the book. Why was that such a high priority for you?
Because I think many young guys are thinking about that a whole lot, and unfortunately the world is offering them a perspective that's not as respectful to women that it needs to be. And in the chapter, we discuss everything from how to talk to a girl to meet her parents for the first time if you're dating her, to how to even balance time with your guy friends and your girlfriends, and then even all the way to how do you respectfully break up with a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And these are step-by-step how-tos because this is top of mind what they need to know. But in addition to the how-tos, there's also a lot of character content in this chapter and all the other chapters. I discussed the resources and the research with world-class experts. As example on that women in dating, Dr. Les Parrott, international bestseller, probably one of the foremost experts when it comes to relationship development. And he gave some really great advice in that chapter, Lee, about what the help you bring into the relationship is the help that you are going to expect to get from the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, bring in your own confidence, build your confidence, treat her as you want to be treated, think of her with using empathy. So it's not just the step-by-steps, it's also quality content for character development. I think that every guy needs that when they're looking at the ladies and they want to know what they're thinking and they have no idea. And we bring some humor in there as well, but give them the tools they need to succeed with 50% of the population.
Yeah, I like it. Jonathan Katterman, he is an author, a consultant, and speaks all across North America on these all-important issues of character development. His new book, of course, The Manual to Manhood. We'll continue with Jonathan in just a few moments. There's a lot more in the book that we haven't discussed. We'll get to it in just a moment. It's Austin Hill in the Morning, back in moments. Good morning, 7:44. I'm Austin Hill. Glad you're with us. Jonathan Katterman, his brand new book, The Manual to Manhood, How to Cook the Perfect Steak, Change a Tire, Impress a Girl, and 97 Other Skills You Need to Survive. He's speaking to men and young boys and those who are trying to raise up the next generation of men. Jonathan, I note that you devote an entire chapter of your book to sports and recreation, things like how to throw a football, how to shoot a basketball, how to hit a cue ball, how to pitch horseshoes. Horseshoes, my goodness, that's almost kind of a lost art. What do you say to the parents that says, well, my son or the young man in our life, he's not inclined towards sports. He doesn't like throwing footballs or playing sports. Is that essential, and how do you address that issue?
Well, I don't think it's essential by any means. But, there's plenty of others, 9 other chapters of let's determine if this is essential or not. It's the sports and rec context of we give them things that if you're at a backyard barbecue and you're in a social event, this isn't go out and compete. This is just, hey, let's, catch this or here, throw that or let's play some pool. You don't want to find yourself in a situation where you and your friends are gathered around a pool table and you don't even know how to hold a cue stick.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're in the backyard and somebody says, hey, I got these horseshoes from my grandpa it sounds like a lost art, but it's a great game, and it's intergenerational as well. We tried to pick sports skills development that were intergenerational and social, not so much as now you're going to go win the championship. This is, again, building relationships, interacting with other people, that this life is more than a digital engagement. This is an actual engagement. This is how you actually engage with other people, and they say, that was a really fun afternoon.
Yeah, fair enough. You also have a section of your book, a chapter entitled Tools and Fix It, subjects like how to use a drill, how to use a crowbar, how to use an adjustable wrench, how to use a level, how to calculate square footage, all very practical and worthwhile sorts of things. I'm struck by a couple of things as I look at that chapter, Jonathan, and for one thing, and I'll use myself as an example, I grew up using tools and doing all those things that I just listed from the final chapter of your book. My teenage son simply has not. Now, my dad was kind of blue collar and sort of white collar, and, he changed the oil and did all the, put new brakes on the car and did all that kind of stuff all on his own. And our economy has changed so much over the course of my lifetime that I don't do a whole lot of those kinds of things. Quite frankly, it's almost more inexpensive or less expensive to take my vehicle and have the oil changed for me rather than buying the filter and the drain pan and the oil and doing it myself. That's just one example. And that is to say that as our economy has changed, a lot of us, even very middle-class folks, we can afford to pay somebody else to do those things and spend our time doing other things. And in the process, using tools and fix-it stuff kind of becomes a lost art. At least that's how I have observed it. Does any of that assessment make sense to you, and how do you address that?
Absolutely it does. I think that you're spot on. When my car, I grew up working on cars as well, and I can barely do anything on any of my vehicles.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. I mean, cars are way more sophisticated today.
That's a whole other chapter, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely,
right.
Yeah.
Well, here's what we did in this case, though, is let's stay away from the complex. Let's go bring back to the simple. And some of the simple things that guys could do that don't require having someone come into your house. Like, here's an example. Finding a stud in the wall. Well, anybody who wants to hang a picture needs to know where a stud is in the wall.
Sure.
So it's something simple like that. So taking the stud finder and beeping it across yourself, beep, 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 yeah, I found the stud, that's calculate square footage, if I'm considering putting in new carpets, or I've got to find out how much paint to buy so I can paint this room, all four walls, I need to know how to calculate square footage. Well, unplug a drain. Little things. You don't need to hire a plumber to come in and unplug a drain. If it's a simple, with a few basic tools, you can get that done. Circular saw, swinging a hammer, using a measuring tape. These are not necessary to hire others when you have a few basic tools and some skills. And it requires a bit of practice. But it's a poor craftsman who blames their tools. And it's an even poorer one who doesn't know how to use them at all.
Yeah, no,
so
that's...
Let's get some simple skills here.
Yeah. And by the way, you also include a chapter in your book, Jonathan, about food and cooking. I'm guessing that for some men and maybe even young boys, they look at that and say, well, cooking, why do I need to know anything about cooking? How has that chapter been met with readers of your book?
Oh, it's been one of the best because you say, well, I can feed myself. Nobody's always around to cook for me. And by the way, guys, nobody should be around to cook for you. We should know how to cook for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
This is some simple stuff, pancakes, scrambled eggs, how to cook some bacon, pasta, mashed potatoes, you know, oven cook a chicken. We're talking about steak and ribs and fish in here, and even how to sharpen that kitchen knife. I mean, these are some, again, there's a lot of respect for the man or anybody who can cook well. And if these guys want to impress everyone from their buddies to their potential girlfriend to their in-laws, just knowing how to cook some basic meals and do them well is always a contribution to any meal versus just opening up a box or popping a can or ordering out. This is again, wow, what an independent guy. He knows how to cook for himself and others.
And don't we want to raise a generation of independent guys? The book, The Manual to Manhood. It's author Jonathan Catherman. You can find him at jonathancatherman.com. That's C-A-T-H-E-R. M-A-N, JonathanCatherman.com. Jonathan, as always, thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you reach many, many people with your work and your speaking. We'll talk to you again soon.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Always great to be with you. 7:51 now on the Faith Radio Network. All right, how would you like to pick up a copy of the latest book from Jonathan? Tell you what, we'll enter your name into a drawing. Call us right now. It's 877-93-FAITH, 1-877-933-2484. Go ahead and call now. We'll get your name into a drawing. We'll draw the winner of a copy of that book, The Manual to Manhood, coming up after the top of the hour. You're listening to Austin Hill in the Morning. Thank you for being here. I'm in the house weekday morning, 6 till 8. Our program continues on the Faith Radio Network. Don't go away. Network where you can reach us all the time on our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. I'm Austin Hill, and thank you for listening to the program this week. It's been an honor just had a thoroughly enjoyable time getting the program launched, getting comfortable in the chair here at the Faith Radio Network. And I am very grateful for your support of the entire Faith Radio Network and its outreach and for being with me here on the show. Now, find more information if you're listening to this new voice coming out of the speakers and saying, who in the world is this guy? Find more info about me. We can get acquainted at myfaithradio.com. And I say that's our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com, because you'll notice if you bring it up in a browser on your smartphone, whether it's an iPhone or an Android or what have you, and we don't want to be too, you know, proud about this or whatever, but you don't need an app. How do you like that, huh? It just configures beautifully on your little teeny tiny phone screen there. Hence, we call it the mobile-friendly website, mypageradio.com. You get more info about that on our website. Now, I want to kind of put the bug in your ear on this one. Coming up on Monday's program, I'm really looking forward to this. We'll have a guest named Greg Howe. Greg is with a group that made a profound impact on my life back when I was a young college student. It's a group called InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, IV, for those in the know. We just call it IV for short. InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. They have chapters on college and university campuses around the country. And as their name implies, they provide Christian fellowship on said campuses. There is a growing problem on non-Christian campuses, non-Christian college and university campuses around the country, private schools and government-run colleges and universities alike. If it is not specifically designated as a Christian or religious college or university, there is grave hostility towards even an authorized club, which might otherwise meet all of the appropriate criteria and requirements for becoming a club. There is increasing hostility towards any kind of group that might identify itself as Christian. Increasingly, we see college and university campuses, as sometimes through the electorate or elective body of the student body officers, sometimes it comes down from the university president, the board of regents, the professional leadership of the college or university itself. But increasingly, campuses are adopting these policies that say, well, you can have your Christian club on our campus, but you can't exclude anybody who isn't a Christian from serving in the leaderships of your InterVarsity chapter or what have you. It does beg a very interesting question. Well, to what degree is an organization, a club, or any organization for that matter, to what degree is an organization still Christian? At what point does it lose its Christian distinctiveness if non-Christians are running the organization or the club chapter? That's a question that nobody really wants to address, and that's where you and I, we have to engage our God-given minds and do some critical thinking. Anyway, Greg Howe, he's with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. He's created, I think, a great response to this growing dilemma. He's calling it the National Day of Prayer for Religious Freedom on Campus. And I do hope you'll just make, at the very least, a mental note and plan to join us for Monday morning's program as we talk with him. Also, Lisa Marone with Monday Morning Health Tips. She's kind of a regular around here, no stranger to listeners of the Faith Radio Network. But as we seek to keep ourselves healthy in a sound mind, healthy bodies, spiritually fit, Lisa Marone is a big asset in that process. So I hope you'll join me Monday morning. Now, that said, if you are listening over a radio station right now, whether it's streaming audio from the radio station website, or if you're listening, you know, the old-fashioned way, broadcast radio signal, that's kind of crazy, huh? If you're listening on your local radio affiliate of the Faith Radio Network, chances are your local radio affiliate carries my weekend program, Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business. That's where we talk about small business ownership and entrepreneurship and making a living. We sort through the issues of the economy, and we try to see those issues through the lenses of our Christian faith. We'll talk about some of the benefits of summer jobs, not just for teenagers or college students, but even preteens. Get them into the workplace. There is great godly biblical virtue that can be inculcated when they work. Talk about that and much more coming up on Saturday. Thanks for listening. Have a great day ahead. This is the Faith Radio Network.